The lesson this morning is entitled, Paul and His Roman Judges. On Paul's last trip to Jerusalem, he was detected by unbelieving Jews in the temple, and his presence there, because of what they knew of his teachings about the relationship of Judaism to the gospel of Jesus Christ and so forth, his presence there in the temple, well, actually started a riot. And as a matter of fact, because of this riot in the temple precincts there, it was necessary for the Roman soldiers to go down and rescue him. Supposedly, we're told this by history, and this seems supported by the text of Acts, that there was a Roman barracks or the fortress of Antonia, I believe it was called, right there at one of the corners of the temple precincts. So it overlooked there was a stairway leading from the temple up to the Roman barracks where the soldiers were living, where they were stationed. And as a matter of fact, Paul was able to make this address to the people in the in the temple plaza from the top of the stairway. That is indicated to us in the book of Acts. But anyway, all of this, that is the riot that occurred around Paul and his rescue by the Roman soldiers, his request to the Roman commander to be allowed to speak to the Jewish mob or rioters there in the plaza of the temple, this all instigated a series of 5 hearings that lasted perhaps over the course of 2 years. In these 5 hearings, Paul, of course, not only defended himself, but he defended the gospel of Jesus Christ. One memorable way to remember some of these later chapters of the book of Acts, specifically chapters 22 through 26, is to remember the individual hearings in each chapter. Like in chapter 22, Paul addressed the Jewish mob. In chapter 23, he addressed the Jewish Sanhedrin or Supreme Council. Chapter 24, he addressed the Roman governor Felix. Chapter 25, the Roman governor Festus. And finally, in chapter 26, he addressed not only Festus, but King Herod Agrippa II and others. So that's one way to give a brief outline to or to remember the main occurrences in several of the last chapters of the book of Acts. Now, the first 2 of these 5 hearings in chapters 22 and 23 actually involved addresses to Jewish audiences. They weren't strictly Roman judicial hearings, but they were arranged and they were overheard by Jerusalem's Roman military commander, about whom I'll have more to say shortly. The 3 other hearings were conducted by before 2 Roman governors and then a king. This was all done in an effort to either resolve or at least to investigate the charges which had been made by the Jews against Paul. And thus Paul stood and made his defense of himself and the gospel of Jesus Christ before 4 Roman leaders who, whether literally or effectively, then were his judges. Hence the title, Paul and His Roman Judges. Now, these 4 Roman leaders proved to be unworthy. I say unworthy judges of Paul or the gospel he preached. Why? Why were they unworthy, really unjust judges? Because they were moved by personal or political interest. These interests prevented them from properly valuing their own souls and the truth of the gospel which could save their souls. They put their own personal or political or earthly interest above the truth of the gospel, and in doing so, above their own valuable souls. Instead, they looked to worldly efforts to relieve them of their worldly problems, which were of greater concern to them. And they were in a dilemma. And I hope to explain that dilemma as we proceed through the lesson. But to relieve themselves of this dilemma, instead of appealing to God, seeing it seemed a greater dilemma as being the fact that their souls were lost. They saw their greater dilemma as being an earthly political one, an immediate problem. And so for one reason or another, these otherwise intelligent and powerful men rejected the gospel which could have saved their souls. They had the opportunity right there before them to hear, evaluate, and obey the gospel and be saved, and they let it slip by. Now, a survey, and that's what we're going to do today, just a brief survey of incidents surrounding these four hearings, or a survey of these four hearings themselves. But a survey of these four Roman judges really presents them to us as effective metaphors or representatives, if you will, for how people have ever since rejected the gospel. In other words, we're really, as a whole, and when I say we, I mean human society in general, we're really not just studying about these Roman governors. We're really studying about ourselves and why people reject the gospel. As a result of reacting to the gospel as they did, all four of these Roman judges failed to obey the gospel when they heard it. It didn't have to be that way. It's interesting that in Acts 13 chapter, Paul visited the island of Cyprus in the northeastern Mediterranean there, and there was a Roman proconsul or governor there. He was named Sergius Paulus. Paul presented the gospel to him. Sergius Paulus, the governor of the island of Cyprus, obeyed the gospel. So Festus, Felix, the others could have done the same thing. So those who wish to save their souls by not making the same mistakes these four Roman judges made would do well to consider how they responded to the gospel, the mistakes that they made, and avoid those mistakes. So let's look at them now, specifically, an individual. And observe that some react to the gospel, first of all, like the Roman military commander in Jerusalem, by the name of Claudius Lysias did. By the way, we know he was named Claudius Lysias because his name is given at the beginning of his letter in Acts the 23rd chapter, verse 26. Claudius Lysias was his name. He reacted to the gospel, I would say, by defiling it with a lie. That is how the truth, I mean, think about it. What is the most defiling thing about truth? I don't think it would be the opposite of truth, falsehood, a lie. And this is what Claudius Lysias, the Roman military commander, did in order to alleviate himself from his problem. Claudius Lysias was the highest Roman military commander in Jerusalem. Actually, the Greek word for him is kiliarch. Kiliarch literally means ruler of a thousand. He was a step above a centurion who was a commander of, as the name would suggest, 100 troops. Kiliarch, kilios, or related word, I'm not sure what the word, how the word is exactly spelled, but it means a thousand, and arch or arche in Greek means ruler. So kiliarch then is a combination of these two words and means ruler or commander of a thousand soldiers or troops. In the absence of the Roman governor, who was headquartered at Caesarea on the Mediterranean coast of Palestine, this man had to serve as Paul's judge. I mean, he was the top Roman ruler, you might say, actually military commander in Jerusalem at the time. Now, you might think that Jerusalem was the capital of Judea. Not to the Romans it wasn't. Not at this time. Remember, at this time, Judea, Palestine is part of the Roman Empire. The Jews and their homeland have been conquered and dominated and occupied by the Romans. And at this time in Judea, actually Roman governors are ruling, although in other parts of Palestine, sons of Herod or descendants of Herod the Great were allowed to rule as vassal kings or rulers to the ultimate ruler, who of course was the Roman emperor. Now, Jerusalem was an inland city, and even though it was the capital as far as the Jews were concerned, where the temple was, the Romans wanted a capital that was more convenient for them, and so they moved their capital, or the headquarters, to the coast, to a town, or city, I should say, called Caesarea. And that's ordinarily where the Roman governor sat, where his headquarters was. And that's why Paul had eventually to be moved from Jerusalem to Caesarea to stand before the Roman governor on trial. So at this point, it's Claudius Lysias who has to decide what to do with Paul. He is effectively Paul's judge on this occasion. After rescuing Paul from the riotous mob, we need to note in Acts chapters 22 and 23 that he had two opportunities to hear Paul present the gospel before Jewish audiences. First, the Jewish mob in chapter 22, and then the Jewish Sanhedrin, as it was called, the Supreme Council of the Jews in chapter 23. And yet, instead of obeying the gospel, he defiled it by lying to protect himself. This is where the lie comes in. Okay? Instead of obeying the gospel, he chose to lie in order to protect himself. How did Claudius Lysias lie? Well, if you were to go back, and I cannot take the time to go into a great deal of detail right now, but you will notice that in chapter 20, at the end of chapter 21 of Acts, this riot occurred, and the troops from Claudius Lysias had to go down, perhaps Claudius Lysias himself, and rescue Paul from the Jewish rioters who were apparently about ready to kill him. And then Paul sought and was given permission to address the rioters from the top of the stairway. That's in chapter 22. That didn't work. So at the end of chapter 22, we see that Claudius Lysias, wanting to find out why Paul has so upset the Jews, orders that he be tortured by scourging in order to extract information from him. Now, I'm telling you this to help you understand why Claudius Lysias lied, because he got himself into a dilemma. Now, it might have been standard procedure for the Romans to torture people to get information out of them. There was one problem, though, with Paul, and it was a big problem for Claudius Lysias. Turned out he was a Roman citizen. So it says in verse 25 of chapter 22 of Acts, "And when they stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, 'Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?'" So he lets him know for the first time, "I'm a Roman citizen." Now, it may surprise you, but probably, I really don't know what the ratio is, but probably a minority, let's put it that way. I think I'm probably safe to say that. Probably a minority of people, maybe a very small minority of people in the whole Roman Empire were Roman citizens. Roman citizenship was something highly valued because it gave you special rights and privileges, certain protections. I've sometimes compared it to being an American citizen, although even American citizens don't have what Roman citizens had back then. But think about it. We've recently had American citizens taken hostage or taken captive by terrorists. And what's happened in some cases anyway? In some cases, U.S. Navy SEALs, special ops teams have been sent in to rescue them. And of course, perhaps in most cases, successfully. American citizens have the might of the United States of America behind them. I mean, it's not like you enjoy that, all of that might to protect you if you're, say, a citizen of Denmark. So you might compare that then, and it's even more the case, with being a Roman citizen during this time. If you, without a trial, punished or scourged a Roman citizen, you're in, as we would say today, very hot water. Notice the reaction here. Verse 27. And the commander came and said to him, back up to verse 26. And when the centurion heard this, that Paul was a Roman, he went to the commander and said to him, "What are you about to do? For this man is a Roman." And the commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" And he said, "Yes." And the commander answered, "I acquired this citizenship with a large sum of money." That tells you something about how valuable Roman citizenship was. People were willing to pay large amounts of money to get it. And Paul said, "But I was actually born a citizen." Therefore, those who were about to examine him immediately let go of him. No, they didn't even have to get an order from the commander. As soon as it was confirmed he's a Roman citizen, back away. It's amazing. And the commander also was afraid when he found out that he was a Roman and because he had put him in chains. This man was a man of great authority. But when he found out that he had, without having officially condemned Paul, put him in chains and was about to scourge him, he was afraid. Not even his position would protect him if he had laid a hand on a Roman citizen. So I say all of that to say that's this man's problem, his dilemma now. He can't just throw Paul to the lions, namely the Jewish rioters or the Jews at all, because Paul's a Roman citizen. If he let a Roman citizen be killed, he's in big trouble. On the other hand, he has to kind of cater to and placate what we would today call his political constituency, although that's not exactly what they were at the time, but in a way kind of comparable to what we would call those people today. So, what's he going to do now? Well, he writes this, he ultimately decides to send Paul to the Roman governor in Felix. Pass the problem on to the Roman governor. Pass it on. Send him up to Caesarea. And he sends him up there with a lot of troops to protect Paul on the way and a letter. Let me read the first two verses of his letter. In Acts 23, verses 26 and 27, Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by him, I came upon them with the troops and rescued him. Making it sound pretty nice, I rescued him. But notice what he says in the next breath, so to speak. Having learned that he was a Roman. Now, folks, that was a lie. That was a flat-out lie. He did not know Paul was a Roman when he rescued him. He didn't find out he was a Roman until later when he was about to scourge him. So he just flat out lied in order to get himself out of trouble. Now remember, here is a man who by this time had heard Paul speak two times to different Jewish audiences. And yet, instead of saying, you know, maybe I ought to hear what this man has to say, he's making sense and ultimately obey the gospel. But instead, he saw his immediate big problem as being an earthly political problem for him, a personal problem for him, you might say. And so he resorted to lying in order to extract himself from that dilemma. Well, when people do not wish to acknowledge the truth, they try to defile it with lies. And it's easy to tell a lie to those who prefer a lie to the truth. For those who love lies, will never challenge a liar to prove his lie. They don't care to have him prove his lie because they want to believe his lie. And yet, trying to silence the truth with lies does not change the truth. May make you feel better for a while, but doesn't change the truth. The truth is reality. And fantasies do not change reality. Let me move on to the second judge now. And point out, in doing so, that some react to the gospel by deferring it. That is, from their viewpoint, procrastinating, delaying obedience to it. And this fact is represented by the Roman governor, Felix. He heard Paul present the gospel. And we have just, I think, four verses to read here. So let's take the time to read those four verses. In Acts 24, the end of Acts 24, verses 24 through 27. And some days later, Felix arrived with Drusilla, his wife, who was a Jewess, and sent for Paul, and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. And as he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, "Go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you." In the memorable words of the King James Version there, he says, "until I find a more convenient season or time." At the same time, too, he was hoping that money would be given him by Paul. In other words, he was looking for a bribe to release Paul. Therefore, he also used to send for him quite often and converse with him. But after 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. So, Felix, the Roman governor here, heard Paul present the gospel. And instead of seeing the gospel as his hope of salvation, he became frightened and dealt with the gospel as many have ever since. Don't want to hear about it. Maybe later, not now. Get away. So he became frightened and sent Paul away, saying that he would summon him when it was convenient. Well, apparently he lost his fright, his sensitivity to the gospel. I say that because later, he was able to send for Paul, and he did so in hope of receiving a bribe. And thus, despite frequent conversations with Paul, he evidently was able to develop a hard resistance to the truth, so that he, as far as we know, he never again gave the gospel serious consideration. Instead, at the end of 2 years, seeking the political protection to be gained by favoring the Jews, he did favor them by leaving Paul in prison. Well, people do the same thing today and have ever since the time of Felix. They continue to react to the gospel by procrastinating obedience. They think that this is a good middle for them to occupy. They don't just disobey it in a real flagrant, open fashion. But they put off obedience to it. Maybe forever. Perhaps they tell themselves that they're not rejecting the truth. They're just waiting a while. They're just delaying obedience until a better time. And what they're really saying is that God has got to wait on them. They've got to have their surfeit, their satisfaction. They've got to be satiated with the pleasures of this world. And when they're done doing that, and they've got all that they want out of this world, then they might turn their attention to the judgment and what would come afterwards. Of course, there are problems with that. The Bible tells us in Ecclesiastes 12:1, in the words of the King James Version, remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. Likewise, Psalm 32, verse 6 says, to seek God in a time when he may be found. Because in a flood of great waters, they might not be able to do that. I'm paraphrasing Psalm 32, verse 6. So, the problem in putting off obedience is that in the time that one puts off obedience, he may become so insensitive to the truth that he can no longer recapture perhaps that initial feeling of sensitivity to the truth. No longer recapture that feeling that he once had, which left him saying, I need to obey the gospel. I've seen that happen many, many times. It's dangerous to put off doing what we need to do when we know we need to do it. Okay, the third judge of Paul then. That would be the Roman governor who succeeded Felix. Felix's successor was Festus. This may not mean anything to you, but I can't read that name without thinking of Gunsmoke. Some of you have, the younger ones of you probably have no idea what I'm talking about. Okay, I won't take the time to explain it. But anyway, Festus, yes. Some people react to the truth by defaming it, speaking badly of it. I say that because eventually, Festus loudly interrupted Paul's defense to tell him that he was insane. We find this in chapter 26, verse 24. Now, Paul is speaking here, defending himself in the gospel. And verse 24 of Acts 26 says, and while Paul was saying this in his defense, Festus said in a loud voice, Paul, you are out of your mind. Your great learning is driving you mad. Now, mad here does not mean angry, it means insane. You're crazy, is what he's telling Paul. However, even before this, Festus so much wanted to curry the favor of the Jews by accommodating their desires that he was willing to expose Paul to the danger of a trip to Jerusalem to stand trial there. And Paul knew that, on the way, the Jews would perhaps, probably, ambush him and kill him or try to kill him. And so because Festus failed in his duty to tell the Jews, you don't have any grounds for this man being imprisoned or even put to death, so I'm going to release him. In other words, basically, these Roman governors are doing what Pontius Pilate did with Jesus. Pontius Pilate, the scriptures tell us, knew that it was because of envy that the Jews had delivered him up to Pontius Pilate. But yet he didn't want to offend the Jews. So because of that, he was willing to allow Jesus to be crucified in order to satisfy them. Well, Felix and Festus are basically doing the same thing. Both of them had the same dilemma that Claudius Lysias had. On one hand, you know, you can't allow a Roman citizen to be killed. But then on the other hand, if you release him, which is what they should have done, then you're going to make the Jews mad. You don't want to do that. And in this case, mad means angry, as I've just used it. So, because Festus failed to do his duty, Paul was forced to appeal to Caesar, which was his right as a Roman citizen. And then, having caused this, Festus tried to involve others to cover up his own irresponsible leadership. It's really almost comical to me. Because now Festus has kind of created another problem for himself. And what do people do when they create problems for themselves? They really mess up? You know what they do? Bring others, try to bring others into it. Get them to share your burden, your problems. Make your problems their problems. And that's exactly what Festus tries to do. How does he do that? Well, later on, King Herod Agrippa II, one of the descendants of Herod, the one we know as Herod the Great, King Herod Agrippa II comes for a visit. It says in Acts 25, beginning with verse 13, "Now, when several days had elapsed, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea, and they paid their respects to Festus. And while they were spending many days there, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, 'There is a certain man left a prisoner by Felix.'" No, he's already putting it off on Felix. It was really Felix who caused this problem, not me. "And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priest and the elders of the Jews brought charges against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation upon him. And I answered them that it is not the custom of the Romans to hand over any man before the accused meets his accusers face to face and has an opportunity to make his defense against the charges. And so after they assembled here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. And when the accusers stood up, they began bringing charges against him, not of such crimes as I was expecting, but simply had some points of disagreement with him about their religion and about a certain dead man, Jesus, whom Paul asserted to be alive. And being at a loss how to investigate such matters, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there stand trial on these matters. But when Paul appealed to be held in custody for the emperor's decision, I ordered him to, for the emperor's decision, I ordered him to be kept in custody until I send him to Caesar." So, what's he doing? He's making himself look at least not so bad. And he's laying the case, Paul's case here before King Herod Agrippa II. So, and he's going to kind of, as much as possible, put the matter into Herod's lap and have Herod join him in responsibility for what's happening now, for Paul having to go. He says, I didn't find, Paul to be, having done anything civilly criminal. It was just a religious matter. Well, he should have let Paul go then. He should have let Paul go. That was his duty. But he got himself in hot water because he tried to curry the favor of the Jews. And as we picking it up in verse 23, it says, "And so on the next day, when Agrippa had come together with Bernice amid great pomp and had entered the auditorium, accompanied by the commanders and the prominent men of the city, at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in." Now, I won't read all what he says because it's basically the same thing. I think it's pretty well summed up. He's saying, if I'm going to send Paul, I want something to say about him that would defend my having to send him to Caesar. So he says in the last verse of the chapter, verse 27, "For it seems absurd to me in sending a prisoner not to indicate also the charges against him." So once he's called in all the prominent men of the city, all the officials and military commanders, whatever. And so he's getting as many people together as possible to say that. So when he writes to Caesar, he can say, "Well, I and all these other people, including King Agrippa here, we all heard this man's case and we couldn't come up with anything, but, you know." So, if he's in trouble, then everybody else is too. It's amazing to me the way sinners work. People ever since have also tried to discredit the gospel and those who believe it by simply calling them bad names or by saying that they are silly or stupid or crazy, as Festus spoke of Paul. They speak abusively of those who present the truth. They try to suppress the truth by using slander to silence those who teach it. The last example is that of Agrippa then, King Herod Agrippa II. He listened to Paul's final defense. He is a representative of those who react to the truth by defying it. And he doesn't sound so bad, you might think, when you read about how he reacted to Paul's defense. You might say, how did he defy the truth? I'll come to that very shortly. So we have here King Agrippa II now listening to Paul's final defense as recorded in Acts 26. Being a ruler among the Jews, He was familiar with both the Old Testament scriptures and the claims made for Christ. Paul said, yeah, I'm happy I'm standing on trial before you because I know that you know all of this, what the background to this. Now, King Herod Agrippa had been there on the scene. He was a ruler among the Jews. As a matter of fact, not Paul, but he was the one who used the word Christian later on in verse 28 by saying to Paul, in a short time, or let me use the memorable wording of the King James Version, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. You may remember that. Paul didn't use the word Christian. Agrippa did. He knew about Christians. He knew the claims that were made by Christians for Christ. So how did he defy the truth? Well, he defied the truth by acknowledging it without obeying it. He said that Paul came close to convincing him to be a Christian, and he acknowledged in private that Paul had done nothing worthy of death or imprisonment and should have been released. You can read that in the last three verses of Acts, the 26th chapter. That constitutes defiance of the truth. So, likewise, all those who do not obey the truth need to realize that their disobedience is not just a benign neglect of the truth, but a brazen defiance of it. Since by failing to obey the truth, they effectively, essentially, virtually, practically deny it. You might say, how is that? Let's look in Titus 1, verse 16. That's what Paul says. In verse 16, he says, this is Titus 1, verse 16, they profess to know God, but by their deeds they, what? Deny him, being detestable and, what? Disobedient. And worthless for any good deed. Paul equates denying God or defying the truth with being disobedient to it. Because really, what are we saying when we don't obey the truth? I mean, if we really believe the truth to be the truth, you would think we would obey it, right? The next logical step, once you acknowledge the truth, is to obey it. So when you don't obey it, you're effectively defying the truth, defying it. In conclusion, then, we see that all four of these Roman judges recognized the truth of Paul's innocence. I won't take the time to read scriptures to that effect. They're in the outline. And as a result of recognizing Paul's innocence, just judges, had they been such, would have released him, but they didn't do so. Why? Because they had greater concern for worldly factors and considerations, just like people today do. And yet, they were not, by any means, the last ones to lose their souls by valuing the advantages which lies and falsehoods and disobedience could give them in this world over what the truth and obedience to it could have given them in the next. Thank you.